Hey everyone, welcome to the Bally Alley Estercast. This is episode number 5, and today is October 5th, 2016. It's been over a month since the last episode was released. That's due to a number of factors. One of them is that Chris has decided not to be a co-host anymore. This is due in part to some changes he wants to make with how he deals with, people who use the content of creators. I'll get more into that, but that's kind of his thing. He's not going to explain it here. So I'm looking for another co-host. I think I found one, Michael DeSalvo. Paul also was willing to do more hosting, so we'll see how that goes in the future. What I'll do here is I'm going to start off with some news, and I'll read a little list. I would love to be able to do the podcast kind of like Ferk does on the 2600 podcast, and maybe just go off the top of my head. I think he has some notes, which is what I've done here. I'm not very good at doing that. I'm not good at talking off the top of my head. I guess that's just the way I'm built. But I'm not a very good reader either, so I can read to myself just fine, but when it has to come out of my mouth, I make a jumble of things most of the time. If only you knew how often I have to re-record parts of this, but I guess part of things is getting past that and getting used to our own voices, which I'm kind of used to my own voice, so I have to say it's pretty damn sexy, right? So here we go. Let's see, in one of the later versions of MAME, they finally fixed a game that didn't work anymore for the Astrocade. It was called Dodge'em and 280 Zap. 280 Zap is actually an arcade game. It's based, I think it came out in 76, and it's a driving game. It's called Dodson 280 Zap. It wasn't working. It used to work in old versions of MES, but then it stopped working when they did an update on how to make it MAME a little more accurate, and this cartridge stopped working, so I posted into a forum and informed some people what some of the issues were based on some information that a member named Richard Degler of the Yahoo group had found out. And they fixed it very quickly. It's pretty impressive how when the community works together, what they can get done. Last month, I used a conversion unit that I have that will let me make videos or create videos using composite input and S-video input, and I bought a video demodulator, which is the opposite of what most people usually have, and it takes RF and makes it into composite. And I use this with my Bally, and I made two videos from Real Hardware. I made a video on YouTube for Bally Basic Demo, which is from 1978, and the Bally Dealer Demo, which is also from 1978, and I posted those on YouTube. I thought I'd be trying to create some more demos, but videos, but I don't think I'll be doing that because this I'm having some severe issues with this hardware that I'm using, and sometimes I can create a video, but then I can't save it, or the program will crash that lets me make the videos, and it's just not working out very well. So I'm going to try to get something else to be able to capture video out of my Bally, and in the future, hopefully I'll make some more videos. It's kind of an enjoyable thing, and one of the videos I want to make is going to be on Bally Basic, maybe a little tutorial on how to use it, or Astro Basic, probably both of them. And even more so, I want to make a video on the Machine Language Manager, which is a 2K cartridge which lets you program in machine language on the Bally without even having any expansion RAM. And it has it's all uppercase, but it has a smaller character set. It's a 3x5 character set rather than the one that's built into the Bally. Since Dodge'em and 280 Zap were made to work in MAME. By the way, when I say Dodge'em and 280 Zap, those are actually one cartridge. Both the games were on one cartridge. And since they were made to work, I decided to poke around at the code, and I disassembled quite a bit of 280 Zap and Dodge'em using some tools that I work with on occasion. I don't really know Z80 assembly that well, but I can poke here and there and figure out things and how it works. And I've used the Nutting Manual, which was used by the original programmers to help figure out how the code works. And I haven't actually posted that yet because I'm not quite satisfied with my results yet, but it's pretty interesting to check out how cartridges work. I encourage people who are interested in that kind of stuff to do it for whatever system they're interested in. It's not easy, and it's kind of time-consuming, but even if you just get a little light bulb going off above your head, it feels kind of good, and I enjoy doing it. I also started disassembling Cosmic Raiders, which is, I think it might very well be my favorite game on the Astrocade, even surpassing The Incredible Wizard, which was my favorite game, and may still be my favorite game. Either way, it's a toss-up between these two. In Cosmic Raiders, it's kind of like a Defender clone, sort of, but you don't have to defend anybody. But it looks like Defender. How's that? It's a horizontal shooter that wraps around and has a radar and things like that. I decided to work on that because it's one of my favorite games, and also because it looks great. It was one of the last releases for the Bally, so it makes it one of the rarer cartridges, and it's 8K, which is, may not sound like a lot, but when you're poking through 8K of a disassembled code and going through the hex values, it's a lot of values. It's 8,192 bytes, and every one of them is in hex, and then you run it through a disassembler, and that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on, but then you got to figure out what is going on. You find the graphics, things like that. Like I said, it's fun to do. Some other news is back in July, I sent I sent a paper letter to someone named Michael Matt. And I looked him up, and I found several people I thought might be him. And I was interested in contacting him because I have some stuff that in the Bob Fabris collection that I've scanned, and it's been online for quite a long time. But he wrote in 1986, which is pretty late, he wrote some articles that he submitted to the Arcadian, which were never published. And this explained how he had taken his Astrocade and upgraded it to be a high-res machine, which is kind of cool. It'll make your system go from, basically it gives it four times the resolution. And this is the resolution of the arcade units. Well, he managed to do this with his Astrocade, and I was wondering, well, I wonder if I can get a hold of this guy. Well, lo and behold, I did get a hold of him. He wrote me an email, which I never received. So eventually, a couple months later, I got an actual letter back. You know, the thing that you have to go to the mailbox, open it up, see what's inside. Sometimes there's paper, sometimes there's nothing. Most of the time it's junk mail. Kind of like a real email box, but old-fashioned, right? Well, I was pretty excited. It was the right Michael Matt, and he said he still actually had his upgraded unit in it, and he'd talked to me about it. He's pretty busy at the moment, he said, but we contacted each other through email, and he's on my safe list now, so I can actually get stuff from him. So hopefully in the future, I'll even if I don't interview him or something, maybe I'll give you guys some more information about high-res units. Some more news in high-res, well, not high-res, but an expansion, is that Ken Lill is working on a new RAM expansion unit. I think I've mentioned this in the past, but he's come a little further, and he sent off the boards to, or sent off the schematics or whatever you need to send off to China, and they're making the boards for him now. This is going to be called the Red, White, and Blue RAM. It's based on the Blue RAM. His earlier white RAM, which was a 32K RAM expansion, but this one's going to be compatible with the blue RAM. It's going to allow you to choose levels of compatibility depending on how much you want to pay for the unit. So I think at the lowest level of compatibility, you'll be able to at least load in blue RAM basic programs, which you can't currently do unless you have a blue RAM basic unit, which is extremely rare. And I don't even have one right now because Paul Thacker is borrowing it. And so, it gives you access to more RAM, and it lets you use an expansion RAM, basic, which is pretty powerful. So I'm looking forward to seeing how progress goes with that. It looks pretty useful. I got an email back in August, I think. Randy Kindig of the Floppy Days podcast, he asked me if I wanted to do a crossover episode. And I said, sure, and maybe we'll get to do that. That'd be kind of fun. However, Randy, if you're listening, I just want to let you know that the Astrocade does not have a floppy drive, so you're going to have to rename your podcast to something like Cassette Tape Days or something like that. We'll see. What else is going on here? We were going to cover The Incredible Wizard this episode. Chris and I were going to do that, but that's being pushed back until the next episode so that I have a co-host to discuss it with. That'll be a lot more fun. As you can see right now, I'm just sort of trying to cover as much as I can as quickly as I can. I'm not sure why, but my wife tells me I speak really fast, and I guess I do. Maybe I should try to slow down now. I'm kind of looking forward to getting some feedback from The Incredible Wizard from some more people. I got some already, which I'm not going to cover till the next episode. In particular, Tim Dorick, you might have heard of him because he used to have the 2600 Connection newsletter back in the 90s, and he also has the 2600 Connection website. He was interested in the Incredible Wizard, and The Wizard of War is one of his favorite games in the arcade, and so I got him some help, and he was able to get MAME set up for Wizard of War and also for The Incredible Wizard. And he's been playing it with his son, and he's going to write me some extensive feedback, which I hope to cover in the next episode. That'll be kind of fun, especially hearing from someone who's young. I'm not sure how old his son is, but I think he's like 10 or 11. Or is that just a guess? I can't remember. It seems to ring a bell. At the end of this episode, you're going to hear Paul and I cover the Arcadian 5 and 6. These are both from 1979, and we cover 11 letters. I'm curious to hear what you guys think about how we cover the Arcadian, and in the future when we cover the other newsletters. I kind of like the way we do it, but we do a lot of reading. It's not something any other podcast that I've ever heard does. So I know some will cover magazines, but they don't go into quite the detail that Paul and I have been going into. Let me know if that's a little too dry, or if it's just right. Who knows? That's great. Currently, the High Score Club for the Astrocade is playing Galactic Invasion and Outpost 19. Well, I played both games, and I put a score out there for Outpost 19, which is the basic bonus game. That game is by Wavemakers, and it's pretty fun. Galactic Invasion is a Galaxian clone, and I encourage you all to give it a try. They're both fun games, and especially Outpost 19. I thought it was released on tape until I started doing some more investigation, and it turns out it probably never was. So it may be Wavemaker's best game. It's kind of you explore this outpost out in outer space, and you're being chased by a monster, and it's written in BASIC. So the game is, the graphics are crude, but it's really quite fun, and I got so enamored with it that I decided to map it. Not freely available on Bally Alley, but I have a way to play the game in under emulation, and I mapped it that way, and there's 16 rooms, and there's teleporters that you can't see that let you teleport from one room to another. It's pretty fun. And if you guys have a real Astrocade out there, you should give it a try, because I think you might enjoy it. A few days ago, I created some graph paper for BASIC, and this is it basically emulates the screen. Emulate? Who uses the word emulate for graph paper? But it uses the same layout as BASIC does for the commands like graphics, like line and box. And that's a layout of 160 by 88, which is, if you're familiar with what I've said in the past about the screen layout of the Astrocade, it has a screen layout of 160 by 102. However, the bottom of the screen is used by BASIC. You lose 14 lines to be used for RAM for the stack and things like that, things that BASIC uses. So BASIC has a slightly limited area as compared to if you're going to be programming a machine language. So something that's not going to sound too related, but is related, is I collect other game systems, not as many as I used to, but one of them I have that I have just four or five games for is the Sega Genesis, and also known as the Mega Drive elsewhere. And so I purchased a flash cart for it. It's called the Mega EverDrive. I think I have the version 2 of it. I think I do anyway. It might be the first one, but I just bought it and I got it a couple of weeks ago. And it lets you play nearly 100% of the Genesis games. And it has a little SD card you shove in the top of it and you can play those. But what it also lets you do, most people aren't too aware, but the Genesis is actually backward compatible with the Sega Master System. It's just not cartridge compatible unless you have like a cartridge converter, which actually Sega did release one, and I have that, and it works pretty good. But this cartridge, since it actually allows you to play the Sega Master System games on it, and I've been playing way more Sega Master System games than I have Genesis games, partially because I'm much more familiar with the Sega Master System library, because I used to have one, and it's a fun system. So, why am I bringing this up here on the Astrocade podcast? Well, the reason I'm bringing it up is because the Sega Master System has the same CPU as the Astrocade, which is the Z80 chip. And I found a pretty fun homebrew game called Bruce Lee for the Sega Master System. And I was playing it and showing it to Chris. And it's pretty fun. In fact, it's better than the versions I've played on the Commodore 64, which is the version I grew up with. And it's much better than the Atari 8-bit version, both of which are really fun to play. But this one, it looks great. I mean, it looks fantastic for an 8-bit game. I just thought it was interesting that there's a really lively homebrew scene for the Sega Master System. And I was thinking, wow, wouldn't it be cool if someone ported Cosmic Raiders to the Sega Master System? I mean, that game is not on any other system, and it's also a Z80 game. So it'd be pretty neat to see someone take up the call and just bring it on over. But that's not going to be me. So, since I've been playing so much Sega Master System, I've discovered that the Genesis controller it's compatible with most of the Sega Master System games, but not all of them. So I converted an old NES pad that didn't work anymore, actually, at all, so that it works now with the Sega Master System. And I removed the start and select button, and now buttons A and B are buttons 1 and 2. So that it works just great on the Sega Master System games. And the games that didn't work with the Genesis, now I have a way to use them. Which brings me to the Astrocade again. I figured, well, now that I had a controller that's semi-Atari compatible, at least one of the buttons is, I figured, why not use it on the Astrocade? So I made myself a Atari joystick style adapter to the Astrocade adapter. Now, that means I can't use the knob, or as the Atari terms, the paddle, at the same time, because there's no paddle built into the Atari 2600 joystick, is there? Unless you're counting, well, let's not go there, but the Atari 2800 and the Sears Video System Arcade 2, which I had back in the 90s, they actually had a... Well, I'm getting way off the subject, but I want to do that when I don't have a co-host. So please, Michael DeSalvo, come rescue me. I could have said that in the voice of Princess Leia, but I just can't go that high. I ended up making this adapter for the Astrocade, and I'm able to use the NES controller on it via the way that now that it's been converted to use the Sega Master System style. And it works pretty good. I played Cosmic Raiders as an experiment, and it controls really well. If in 1978 Astrocade had come out with the NES controller instead, well, I guess it couldn't have really worked out that way, but it would have been great having keypad controllers back then. For most games, especially Jumpman on the Atari, I prefer the Atari 2600 controller, but in certain situations I think the D-pad controllers work pretty well, and they have a place. They really deserve to be in use on classic systems. On, for instance, I'm going to be using it later today to be playing some games with my nephew, and because he's much more familiar with that kind of style joystick. And, you know, when I throw in a 2600 controller in his direction, he just doesn't know what to do with it. And I might introduce him to Archon tonight. I don't think he's played it before, and if he has, then he's going to play it again and really... Well, he's 13, so he probably won't cry, but maybe he will, because he's going to lose. All right, so that's pretty much it for the news. As I've already said, I had not a lot of feedback, but some feedback. And most of it, well, all of it except for one letter, it concerns The Incredible Wizard. So I won't be reading that this episode since I'm not covering the game. But I did get one piece of feedback, and this is from Michael DeSalvo, who hopefully will be the host or one of the co-hosts on the next episode. Here's something that he says. He says, I found something interesting. You and Paul are talking about people being able to write in and get a Bally Home Computer Library cartridge bay label if they were unhappy with the system being renamed. I'm thinking the Bally Professional Arcade? Well, with me, it was the opposite. When I got my Bally computer system, not long after Astrocade started advertising the new system and the new name on TV, and of course I wanted an Astrocade system, not a Bally. Would have been great if they let us write in and get a new label, but I never tried. It's okay. Only took me like 30 years later to actually own a couple of Astrocade branded systems. There's someone who would have preferred to have the old label. Or the new label. I guess he wanted the new label, didn't he? Well, Michael, you can talk about that on the next episode. The Bally Arcade, or the Astrocade, it has the four built-in programs. You've heard this podcast, you might have the Astrocade or at least used it, so you're probably already familiar with the games. They're Gunfight, Scribbling, Checkmate, and a Calculator. I've always been curious who programmed the games, and I thought it had popped up before in the Bally Alley Yahoo groups, so I decided to check into that, and it did pop up before a long time ago, I think in like the early 2000s. So I went through and I kind of figured out who programmed the games, which I'm really happy to find. It took me, I mean, no one came out and said exactly like in a list format, like here's who programmed the games. So I went through several messages and I'm going to not really quote them per se, but first let me give you a listing. What we have here is that ROM, it was actually worked on by about five different people. We have Jay Fenton, who programmed Astro Basic and early arcade games. And I'm not sure if Jay ended up writing any of the cartridges for the system or not. There's some cartridges, but I don't know who programmed them, and maybe Jay did. So Jay programmed Scribbling, which is one of the fun games that you can play with four people at once. And he also did a lot of the background programming, so I guess a lot of the code that was done for that the other games used. It's called the HVGSYS, which is Home Video Game System. So those are like ROM routines. Alan McNeil wrote Gunfight. Ken Freud, I'm not sure how you say that, F-R-E-U-N-D. He did miscellaneous code, I'm not sure what that means. Lou Harp programmed Checkmate, which is kind of odd. I always presumed that Jay Fenton did, because Jay Fenton wrote Checkmate for the arcade. I think I just realized that I said Scribbling was a fun four-player game, but that's Checkmate. Scribbling is just a little drawing game. And Jeff Fredrickson, he wrote the calculator, and he was, quote, the brains behind the project. So to back up some of this information, I'm going to read from the past messages that I found on the Yahoo message board. Tony Miller wrote in message 1150, quote, in fact, TERS, which is a computer language, it stands for TERS Efficient Reentrant Stack Engine, was written by Al McNeil, who also wrote the Gunfight built-in game for the arcade and such coin-op classics as Berserk and Frenzy. TERS was at one time planned as an alternate language for the arcade computer add-on before Zgrass gained popularity at Dave Nutting Associates. Ricky Spice chimed in quite a bit later and said, Tony, you are correct that Alan McNeil wrote the original TERS engine. However, TERS stands for TERS Efficient Recursive Stack Engine. And Tony replied to Rick, says, I remember asking him what it stood for, and he said reentrant, but then again, they say that memory is the second thing you lose. I forget what the first is. I was actually the first guy I stole from DNA when I was staffing up URL. And I wasn't sure what URL was, but Chris Federico came to the rescue and let me know. He says, the group that Tony refers to as URL was Universal Research Laboratories, Stern's development-specific subsidiary. And he talks about some of this information in his own article on Frenzy, which I'll post about in the show notes. In past episodes, I've made mention of the Astrocade chipset being used in several other arcade games in the in the late 70s and early 80s. Back in the early 2000s, I tried to come up with a list of all these games by going through Midway's catalog of arcade games, and they made a lot of games that used the 8080 and Z80. Quite a few of these games, actually, were ported to the Astrocade. Games such as Amazing Maze and Datsun 280 Zap and Seawolf 2 and Tornado Baseball and what else? Just a whole bunch of them. You wouldn't have expected it, really, but it happened. And some of these games people never even had heard of. But not all these games that Midway was releasing used the Astrocade chipset. But some of them did. And those that did all were high-res games. And I'm going to give you a list of what they were. They were Seawolf 2, which appeared in 1978. Extra Bases, which appeared in 1980. Space Zap, which is a really fun game. And it actually didn't use a controller. I've never seen the arcade game, but it used four giant buttons for the direction you want to shoot. And there's a couple of cool videos of it being played on YouTube, if you can find one. Oh, in fact, I'll just link to one in the show notes. It's a pretty fun game to play, and it's worth getting on the Astrocade as well. There's Wizard of War, which was released in 1980. That used the Astrocade chipset. There was Gorf and The Adventures of Robbie Roto, which is kind of a much maligned game. And while I don't think it's a great game, I think it's pretty important because it's one of the very, very few games that actually is freely available to be used with MAME. And Jay Fenton, who wrote the game, made it freely available. Not too many games are like that, so it's important to keep that in mind. Back in 2006, Frank Palazzolo, he made me a list of some other games that I didn't cover, and that's because these were prototypes, and most of them I hadn't even heard. Well, at the time I hadn't heard of none of them. There was one called Demons and Dragons, which is an unreleased prototype. At the time, in 2006, it was emulated in MAME but without sound. I don't know if that's been fixed. I haven't looked recently. Professor Pac-Man, which is a video quiz game, which is not too fun, but that is emulated. And then there was an electromechanical bowling game all the way from 1984, which is not emulated because it's electromechanical. And then there's 10-Pin Champ, Strikes and Spares from 1985. And those all use the Astrocade chipset, which basically means it used the data chip. And all the other chips required in the Astrocade that were the custom chips. Tony Miller chimed in after I wrote this to the Yahoo group, and he said, a good portion of these, most if not all of the 8080-based black and white games, were done by Nutting. These include Gunfight, Seawolf, Dotson 280 Zap, Checkmate, etc. The hardware for all of these was done by Nutting. A close inspection of the schematics will reveal discrete versions of the flopper, shifter, etc. used in the data chip that is inside the Astrocade. Space Invaders was a Japanese license, as was Bosconian, Galaga, etc. He goes on to say, another reason for the paucity of Bally professional arcade-based games was the popularity of Pac-Man et al. During the same period. Which is kind of interesting. I find the most interesting part of that to be that like the flopper, the shifter and stuff that are built into the data chip were actually built with discrete components in the arcade games, which gives the Astrocade more of a history. You know, it's really, I don't know, I find it interesting. I really wish that I could ask Tony these questions, because as I've said in the past, Tony passed away in a few years back. So I should have jumped on the ball back when I had the chance. So Glenn Saunders chimed in as well, and he says, what I see is that all of the arcade hardware is based on similar architecture all the way back to Gunfight, and it just gets refined over the years, even into the era of games like Spy Hunter and Rampage. They went from the 8080 to the Z80, added more RAM, added color, faster clock speeds, etc. But it's all based on the mass RAM concept, i.e. bitmap with bit manipulation functions and hardware. The funny thing about Spy Hunter is that the soundboard has a way more powerful CPU, the 68000, than the main system CPU, which is just the Z80. And Glenn Saunders has one more thing to say in a separate posting. He says, because Tony Miller had commented that Space Invaders was a Japanese license, and Glenn says, during my interview with him, Dave Nutting said, if I recall correctly, that the Japanese had ripped off the 8080 board when Bally Midway found out about it. As part of some arbitration, they came up with a licensing deal to bring over the games they had designed, such as Space Invaders. And there you have it, some information on the arcade games that are based on the Astrocade chipset. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do for one of the upcoming Astrocasts, maybe 6, 7, 8, maybe somewhere down the line. I'm going to cover Robbie Roto, or excuse me, the proper name is The Adventures of Robbie Roto. I hooked up my X-Arcade twin stick a couple weeks ago, and I ended up playing it for a while, and it's a pretty fun game. It's I know it was... It's covered once in a while. I've never heard any reviews of it on any of the podcasts, although I know they've covered them, but I've not wanted to bias myself by listening to them. I'm probably going to end up covering it, and maybe even examining the code if I can figure out how to dig my way in through there, but it's so much bigger than an Astrocade game, and I was just saying earlier in the episode that examining an 8K game is trouble enough, but I imagine these arcade games are much bigger than 8K, but... And it's another thing, I don't, you know, they all were on different ROMs, and in main, I'd have to figure out how to take all these ROMs, put them into one area, and figure that out. But I'm sure someone on some news groups could help me figure that out. I mean, after all, there's been people who have gone through some of the code for, like, say, Wizard of War, and GORF, probably, and I haven't found any comment code for GORF, but there has been some commented code for Wizard of War. And I find that kind of stuff interesting, since the Astrocade shares so much with the arcade games. The arcade games did have some advantages, like extra chips and things like that, especially later on in games like GORF and Wizard of War, but they're still very similar. Well, that's about all I've got for this episode, except for what I covered with Paul about the Arcadians newsletters and the letters, which you'll be hearing next. Talk to you guys next month, and in the meantime, if you haven't hooked up your Astrocade lately, why don't you do that and have some fun? We'll start off with the Arcadian number 5, which is the March 23rd, 1979 issue. One of the things I want to read the first paragraph I wrote here, and it says, the programming keyboard is still said to appear in July, August, but this seems quite impossible to me. Bally is trying to decide if there should be two types of programming keyboards, one with lesser capability for about $300, and one that is fully capable, not compatible, for $600. Bally is trying this new course because customer feedback on the newly stated $600 price has encountered some, quote, resistance.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, $600 for that Zgrass keyboard. I mean, it would have added some more RAM, and it would have given them a new language. But that's really it, right? What else would it have done for them? Another thing that's mentioned is that the 18-page hacker's manual has appeared, and that some dealers are carrying it as an addendum to the regular basic manual, which is a good idea because it provides quite a bit of information that the original manual didn't have.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that I've seen the hacker's manual mentioned here is that I've been thinking about
going through the basic manual again. I kind of mentioned this in passing to you, but I actually took out my basic manual while I was typing up some of these programs because I was realizing that they do a lot of weird things in this version of BASIC to get around some of the shortcomings of a Tiny BASIC, or Bally BASIC, as most users would be familiar with calling it, I guess. And I don't really know where these people got this information because it's not really in the hacker's manual. I guess they must have gotten it from like just the newsletters in general, or exchanging it, information between them, friends or something. Do you know what I mean? Have you looked at the BASIC programs much, or have you just like archived tapes?
You mean like actually like going through the code?
Yeah, just, I mean, I don't mean examining and writing your own program from scratch or anything, but have you like taken even a semi-close look at how Bally BASIC functions, or Astro BASIC, basically the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely get some ideas, and yeah, I mean, some of the tutorials are interesting because, yeah, like it's in one of these issues that they were going over like how you would do an and statement or an or statement, because you know, like they don't explicitly have those operands like you would in most modern languages, but you know, there are ways to get around it.
Yeah, even Commodore BASIC I think had that, so or PET BASIC, whatever it was called back then. So it was a shortcoming that most people probably missed. And if you were to buy a book on BASIC back in 1979 for your Bally, because that's all you could get, it wasn't like you could get a Bally BASIC book, you're probably going to get a book that was going to be talking about maybe Apple BASIC or Microsoft BASIC, which neither of which were compatible at all with Tiny BASIC. So.
Yeah.
So let's see. Next thing up here, we've got Jim Unruh. He's working on a scheme to connect two Bally arcades via the tape interface for, quote, interactive programming. No details are given. However, when I was looking through the Bob Fabris collection, I came upon a letter that was dated December 25th, 1980. I guess he had the day off that day. Jim states that he has finally succeeded in interactive programming with two machines and is able to have two people on two different Bally arcades playing Rock Shears Paper, which is a program from the Bally BASIC manual, and they play against one each other. I guess I'll cover this a little more later down the road, but I think it's pretty neat that someone was working on trying to get two arcades, I guess, in the same room, as far as I know, to communicate with each other. For those that aren't aware, the S100 bus was first released on the Altair computer. This is why the S100 bus is sometimes referred to as the Altair bus. If the letters to Bob and the Fabris collection are any indication, then many people were interested in somehow gaining S100 capability on their Bally arcade units. Bob gives a news bite that Pete Wishart is trying to connect the S100 compatible Z80 CPU board from SD Sales to the 50-pin expansion connector on the 50-pin connector on the back of the Astrocade, and there are still some bugs to work out, which I found pretty weird because I don't know how you'd get 100 signals from 50 signals on the back of the Astrocade, but I could see why people would want to do it. It was a standard at the time, and all the computers were using it. And I did look up this board, and I found some information about it online. And what I didn't realize is that some of the the S100 bus computers, you could just like exchange the CPU, like and put in like a 6800 CPU. So you'd have these CPU cards. And so I guess that's what this thing was. So you could have a 6800 or a Z80 or an 8080. I can't remember what other popular, maybe a 6502, but I don't think so. But kind of interesting. It's another thing that sort of separates the Bally from the say the Atari 2600, and that people were trying to do weird things like this. The next page has got a tutorial on how to use the onboard calculator, which is only available for Bally BASIC and was taken out of Astro BASIC.
Yeah, so you needed that if you wanted to do some like your mortgage calculations and, you know, some people actually wrote some pretty specialized programs.
Yes, they did. Yeah. And that was actually put back into like BluRAM BASIC, for instance. So I guess you could actually take advantage of that. But so in like way down the line in like the last volume of the Arcadian in like 1985, those early Bally BASIC programs that were printed like in 1979 were updated for BluRAM BASIC so that they could take advantage of and be used again. The next page talks about Tom Wood. It doesn't talk about Tom Wood. It's a tutorial by Tom Wood on how to use the print pound in order to justify your text. I guess, if you find that interesting. Bob has a list of some of the user-written programs that have come in lately. Some of them are printed in upcoming issues, and some of them aren't.
So, yeah, I thought that was a little surprising that he named some of the programs that he never actually printed. So, yeah, with Bally Trek, we mentioned before, and that's...
Yeah.
And, Strategy Football is one that I archived that was never published. It was kind of a confusing program, actually, but interesting.
Yeah. You know, and even if it had been published, it probably would have been even more confusing because he probably wouldn't have published the instructions for it, which was pretty typical. Let's see. Four subscribers are selling their own programs on tape in our basic listings. And I'm going to kind of go into... something I found interesting here. Bob Weber has 12 programs available at $2 each, but you must supply your own tape. Now, this is something that goes on and on throughout the newsletter. The people who are selling programs always wanted you to send in a tape to them. It seems like, were tapes really expensive back then, just a blank tape? How much did one cost?
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought it was that much, but I don't know. And I mean, you have to worry about the extra shipping, you know?
Yeah, it's very true. Let's see. Bob Schwenk is selling 3 programs. Bob Strand is selling 7 programs. And here's something I found interesting. George Hale is selling a program called Sonic Satellite. And have you played that program before?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. And I don't know if you remember, but it's kind of like a Missile Command ripoff. But I didn't realize that it was published so early. And this is the spring of 1979, and Missile Command doesn't come out until 1980. It's not a Missile Command ripoff at all, you know? It's...
Yeah, maybe Missile Command ripped off Sonic Satellite.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, damn you, Atari. that's funny. Yeah, well, and I have this original program listing in my archive. It wasn't part of the Fabris collection, but Richard Hauser had it. And what I thought was neat about it was each program listing was hand-numbered individually and given to the person who bought it. And their name was like put in the program listing. I don't know if it's like so Richard Hauser's name is actually in the program when you look at it online in the listing. It's kind of, it was, I guess, his form of copy protection.
Yeah, it's both foolproof.
Exactly, foolproof. on the next page, we've got the memory map for Bally Basic. And this is just reprinted from the Hacker's Manual. So if you didn't have the Hacker's Manual, then you would at least have it. And let me take a look at that here. It's worth noting, too, that the memory map changes quite a bit from the Astro Basic when that version comes out. And that's, since that's the version most people are familiar with, I'm probably not going to go over anything here. Not that there's much to go over. Bore you to death, I guess. Someone talks about how you don't have to use the last closing quotation in order to save a byte. And this is something that people go over a lot, is how to save one byte of code so that you can use it for something else later on.
Yeah, it definitely made a difference.
Yeah. It's kind of unusual, though, when you're typing in a program and you see stuff like that, because it almost seems like a mistake, because it's ingrained in my head, like, gotta close your quotes, gotta close your quotes. There, on this page, there's also another division routine by someone named Pete Bowman. It's just 8 lines long, and it says, and Bob says, it's a bit laborious as you have to enter each decimal number into an array. And I was looking at it, and it looks like a pain in the butt to use. And I'm glad that I've never had to do anything with math in Bally Basic. Something they discovered, too, was that, the note time, which is available in Bally Basic and Astro Basic, you can change it. You can give it pretty much any value, but only values 0 through 3 are really do anything. And something I didn't realize until I read this was that if you change the value, not only does it speed up how fast it prints to your screen, it speeds up how fast it prints the tape, which I guess is pretty, can save a little bit of time for loading and saving tapes. But they say don't do it too fast because then you won't be able to make it work at all. So the next page has an event of sorts, I guess you could say. It's page 35 is a program by Brett Bilbray and Joe Borrello, I'm guessing it said, and it's Simon. So it's the first basic program, full program, that's a game, I guess. They've had little snippets here and there, but it's the first program of hundreds that will eventually be printed. And if you typed it in, I would love to say that you'd be able to play Simon, but you would not have, because there are quite a few errors in this program, which are fixed over the next several issues.
Yeah, so some of the letters are kind of amusing about that.
Yeah, some of the that we'll be going over today.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't, have you ever played Simon before?
I believe so. You know,
on just, the Astrocade.
It's simple kind of memorization game.
Yeah, it has pretty good use of colors though. I was surprised when I tried it years ago. I haven't played it since. I don't know. I guess 10 years ago isn't that long ago, considering it was published almost 40 years ago. And, you know, it's worth noting that Brett Bilbray has been talking just in the last couple of days on the Valley Alley newsgroup or message board on Yahoo. He's been trying to help me figure out how to, or several people have been trying to figure out how to, I've been disassembling Cosmic Raiders, the AK cartridge, which is, yeah. I don't know what decided to make me do that, probably because I've been playing it and I was just curious how the graphics are drawn. And I still don't understand it because they draw really quickly and there's scrolling and like the ground scrolls. And but I'm having fun doing that. And I was wondering what was my specific question that I came up with? Oh, it was something was written to the output board and it didn't make sense to me. So I was asking and no one really could come up with an answer right away, but some people had some good ideas. But Brett was one of the people who bounced up or rose his hand and said, maybe I can help you out, which I thought was pretty neat.
Yeah, if anyone would know, it would be him.
Yeah, right. He's written two cartridges for the system. The next page has a clock, or two programs. One's a clock and one's a program that will convert hex to decimal. I don't know if you've ever tried any of the clock programs. I have, and I actually just typed one in recently. And they're pretty amazing because they're not accurate at all. And they just use loops for timing, so they sort of have to wing it. And luckily, you never can overclock your Astrocade. Otherwise, your clock just wouldn't function.
Right.
You know, speaking of overclocking, I was Chris was over here last night, and we were watching a movie called Man vs. Snake, The Story of Nibbler. Have you ever seen that?
No, I think I saw the trailer for it. Is it any good?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It was I rented it from Amazon for about $5, and something that happens is there's a guy who sets over a billion. He gets over a billion points, but he does it really quickly, and it turns out his board is defective, so they don't accept his score because his board is it's not. He didn't overclock it, but I guess there's some malfunction on the board that's making the 6502 run faster than it should, and it's to his advantage because he's able to play the game for 35 hours and get a really high score. If you get a chance to watch that movie, you should. So we've got a program that will let you convert hex to decimal, and that's by Ernie Sams. And while that's not a big deal because you think, you know, you can just use a calculator to do that when one is built into Windows, but Valley Basic has a different way of dealing with hex decimal that is not normally used.
This is going back to kind of the beginning of the newsletter, but I thought there was probably a bad idea that they were talking about making two versions of the Zgrass expansion, because, you know, it seems like it's going to be a pretty small market to start out with, and then they're talking right from the start about splitting it up in two, basically.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have to worry about, well, do you have the Zgrass that can run these advanced programs, or, you know, is only a few people actually run those?
Yeah, yeah. Like the Atari 400 would ship with originally 8K of RAM, and then you didn't upgrade it. You had a unit that was capable of doing a lot if you added more RAM. So I guess it's always been that way with computers. I mean,
yeah.
You had the people who had the low-end systems, and it's that way to this day, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. Let's see. So I think this is the first time we've seen the name Star Battle. You know, before they were calling it Space Race, just back in issue 3. So, we'd already talked a little bit about how that game developed. That kind of makes me think that they didn't really make a lot of changes from Space Race. They just kind of gave it a new title.
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah, I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, and then they're still talking about releasing Drag Race, Desert Fox, and Checkers Backgammon. So, you know, it's interesting that those seemed so close to coming out, but never actually were released.
Yeah. Maybe if we write a letter to Bally tomorrow, we can have them send us their prototype cartridge. What do you think?
Yeah, we should try that.
Dear Bally.
Yeah, we mentioned there were several ads for programs. So probably the most significant is Bob Weber from you know, he was behind W&W software sales, so they were a pretty prolific early developer, and, you know, almost all of those have been archived if you want to check them out.
Most of them only are compatible with Bally Basic, though, right?
What I found was mostly in Bally Basic. Now, I believe that later on he advertised Astro Basic versions of all the games, so I've never actually seen, like, complete collections of those. Now you might be able to just, you know, convert them. I don't know if he really made any changes to them or not.
Probably he would have probably had to, because the sound was done so differently in Astro Basic that, I mean, you could sort of compensate for it by setting NT equals -1, but it still required some changes. And I've noticed that most programs that are in two different versions are pretty different. Or different enough that it's noticeable.
Yeah. So I guess at that point, those programs were pretty old, so I wouldn't be surprised if not a whole lot of people ordered them in the Astro Basic.
Yeah. Something I want to continue on page 39. One of the interesting uses of the Bally is it's being used by one user to operate a TV booster system, capturing long-distance TV signals on mountaintops and rebroadcast them into valleys that normally lie in the shadow. The Bally is used to insert commercials, and programs are developed using the graphics capability to generate logos and are used for screen wipes, color changes, etc., which, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but I don't suppose you know who that was.
I don't know. I don't know who that is at all. It would be neat if I found out. You know, now that I'm going through letters and stuff, it's quite possible that in an upcoming episode when I'm trying to find information, like, maybe I'll find that letter and I'll note it.
Yeah, it could definitely be in there, but, you know, hard to find something if you don't know a name to look for.
Yeah, there's thousands and thousands of documents to go through, so it's... Yeah, it's when I see how much I have, like in 8 boxes, which doesn't sound like a lot, but they're crammed full of paperwork, you know. Bob talks about a book that he recommends called The Basic Handbook that tells you how to translate from one version of Basic to another, which is useful for people who have tiny Basics, since it's not really compatible with most Basics, except for 10 print Hello World, you know.
Yeah.
Bob was wondering if people have any way to print out their programs. Something I guess we should mention is these programs that are, quote, printed here in this issue, they are all handwritten. So whoever wrote them, they did a pretty good job at writing them down. But that's how these errors are introduced, because they're looking at their TV screen and jotting down what they see onto a piece of paper. So that's where all these – maybe their program worked perfectly when they wrote, you know, their program originally, but that translation, getting it down to paper, what a pain.
Right.
One of the programs, you know, speaking of, I was saying that I typed in some programs. One of them that I typed in was one that was, who's the guy from ABC Hobbycraft? Is it Guy McLemore or something?
Yeah.
I typed in one of his programs that wasn't published anywhere. It's called Self-Portrait. And it's actually, it just draws a ballet astrocade on the screen, which is kind of cute. So I'll try to upload that next week or something like that. On page 40 of issue 6 is a pretty cool tutorial by John Perkins that explains the details of how a basic program is able to store itself in RAM and how to use basic ports. And the significance of it being written by John Perkins is, of course, that John Perkins went on to release – he and his father, Clyde, went and released the Bally RAM expansion, the Blue RAM. Yeah, so which is and he did a lot. He actually, I was gonna say he wrote Blue RAM Basic, but Jay Fenton wrote Blue RAM Basic, and I think he made some changes to it so they would work with the Blue RAM. So we've got another tutorial by Bob Weber on another tutorial that's on explanations, like you were saying earlier, on and OR. One of the programs I played recently was Fox and Hounds. Have you played that before?
Yeah, is that the Esoterica one?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like a board game too. It's kind of like almost like a miniature checkers kind of game. You have to, what do you have? You play. How did it work? I'd never played it, and I was looking through the cursor programs that hadn't been archived, and that had been archived, but I was wondering if it was the same as the one that was in a cursor, which it is. And it was actually a pretty fun little program. You play with like four kings against one king or something. You have to trap them.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've tried that one.
I'd never heard of it before, but I'm sure it's probably something people have... it's probably based on something people do on a real board, you know?
Yeah.
So we've got another program, I think. Or no, not graph paper. We've got graph paper that's created by Chuck Tomka, which is helpful if you're going to set up your screen. You can download that on Valley Alley. Got a couple of more programs you can type in. One's a random art program, which is possibly the most popular kind of program ever printed in the Arcadian, I would say, are programs that just draw random art on the screen.
Yeah, I had those throughout the lifetime of the system, pretty much.
Yeah. And some of them are actually pretty neat to look at, but, you know,
we're
kind of spoiled today, so they're probably not as interesting as they were back in 1979. we've got another version of the Arcadian, or the Game Over subroutine that was printed in the February issue. This time it prints out Arcadian at 2 times the normal size of the letters. And it doesn't work for Bob because he's got a different version of the ROM, but they don't quite realize that yet. Let's see what else we've got here. I'm going to read out something I wrote here because it says, Bob urges subscribers to write the details of their desires for the programming keyboard to Jack Nyman, the director of sales for Bally. Bob hopes that this will help push Bally to release the Adunder. 11 months later, in the April 1980 issue of Arcadian, Bob announces that S&W Distributing is a national distributor for all Bally products, except for those from Montgomery Wards. And by this time, Jack Nyman, who was actively involved in the S&W operation, is the former national sales manager for Bally Consumer Products. I don't remember reading anything about it, and I thought this was pretty interesting. So on this last page, we've got a new something that's going to run for every issue from now on, and that's the classifieds. I guess one of the things I'll talk about is, because I found this totally confusing, is a guy called Gene Taillefer. He's got 21 games for sale, and he does not list the games that are available. You've got to write them for a list. It's this pricing structure that is pretty weird.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
I want to talk about it just a minute here. You don't pay per program. Instead, you pay for per minute of recording time. For $1, you get 1 minute. For $2, you get 3 minutes of recording. And for $3, you get 5 minutes. Now, I think that's weird.
Yeah.
Considering that a 300 baud tape is takes about three to four minutes to load, what was the point of doing that, you know?
I mean, I guess I read it more as like the longer programs were more expensive, which makes some sense, I suppose.
Yeah.
So some of the people really early on, it's like they just, you know, wrote like 20 programs as fast as they could and advertised them all. So it probably wasn't of the highest quality looking. You know, in this case, I've never seen any of those programs, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And most of these programs I've learned early on that are listed are also just programs that were changed from the Bally Basic Manual. So
yeah.
So here's something that's interesting. We've got the first person giving up on the Bally already. He's selling his unit for $300 with 6 cartridges. But it was a little confusing to me because he lists some of the things that I don't know what they are. He lists a demo basic and a demo tape interface. Now, the demo basic might be the basic demo, which actually I loaded up a video last week or the week before. So that's probably what that is. But do you know what the demo tape interface is?
Does it just mean the tape that came with the 300 baud interface?
I don't know what it means. Maybe that could be. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. I was thinking it was a piece of hardware that was like a. But you're probably right. It's probably just the tape that came with the. But I don't know. I thought it was a piece of hardware, but yeah, you're probably right there. And then we've got David Stocker, who's selling some programs, and I'm only mentioning his ad here briefly because we've got a letter in it that we'll be going over. So that covers the 2 issues of the Arcadian. So is there anything else you want to add about those 2 issues?
Well, we could talk about David Stocker a little bit, but we could wait till his letter.
Or we could talk about him now. I mean, either or. What he's selling here, I guess I could mention what he's saying. What he's selling, he's selling 2 sets of programs on tape. He's selling a set of games which contains 9 programs, most of which aren't even games, and also another program which is video art. As I was just saying, there's a lot of that for the Bally. That's 15 programs. They mostly are just modified programs from the Bally Basic Manual, and these are one collection is $8, or you get them both for $10. What a bargain.
Yeah, so those actually have been archived, and it was kind of funny. I don't know if you remember, but I when I posted about archiving them, I had not realized at the time that David Stalker was in the Yahoo group, and he posted back about how that was like the first software he'd ever sold.
Yeah. I actually, I wrote that down in the notes. I actually put some quotes from him, which is kind of a, which I thought were really, that was one of the reasons I picked this letter to put in here, because of when you posted, I remembered him replying.
Yeah.
Which I thought was, it's neat that once in a while we get like people from the old days who are members of the group that will say something.
Yeah, and it does show how that, you know, it was really a good way to get an introduction to programming if you had a basic cart.
Yeah, and I remember there's a couple of things about the Bally that I always thought were interesting. And one of them was I always wondered, was there anyone who ever got their start programming on the Bally and then went on to become professionals? And obviously there have been. And another one, which Lance answered for me, was I wondered if anyone actually used their calculator for anything. The calculator is built into the Bally. And I remember Lance said he and his brother used to use it to do their homework. So I thought that was, I was like, oh, well, there you go. So up next, we've got a number of letters. I think I have 11 or 10, 11 letters. Yeah. So the first one, the earliest one is from February 3rd, 1979. And it's from Tom Woods. He's got an explanation of the onboard calculator. And this is basically what was printed in the Arcadian that we were talking about, but he goes into a little bit more detail, and he actually, Bob actually expands on the letter, I think, a bit. I'm only mentioning it here, and this is what I said in my notes too, is because one of the things I'm finding about going through and looking through these letters is it's just fun to read through some of these letters, and getting them online, this is a great excuse to do it.
Yeah.
This is one letter I'd like to get online. From George Hale, dated Valentine's Day, 1979. And George Hale has used an ohm meter to trace out the 50-pin connector on the back of the unit. He has included an illustration of it. And he's not 100% sure if he's right, but you can see that every pin in the Z80 is present on the 50-pin connector. Now, the Bally PA-1 service manual doesn't explicitly give this 50-pin information in an easy-to-read and illustrated format, as George creates in this letter, which is kind of useful. But the Bally Arcade schematic does provide the necessary information to be extrapolated. Also, the third page of this letter was written later on, and it's a one-page letter to someone named Charles Vollmer. I'm not sure how it got into the Fabris collection, but it did. George explains that his letter to Bob crossed in the mail with his receiving the Bally service manual. He notes that most of the information he figured out is correct, although he numbered his 50-pin connector in reverse order.
Yes. Yeah, so sometimes people would just send Bob a copy of, you know, correspondence they had with Bally just to kind of keep him updated on what information they were getting.
Oh, okay.
So I'm imagining that's what happened there. Charles Vollmer was, I believe, one of the sales managers. Was it Richard Belton had talked about a phone call with him?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I know. Yeah. In the last issue that we were talking about, or last at the podcast when we were talking about Richard Belton.
Yeah. Maybe it might have been the podcast before. Did you notice on the very first paragraph of George's letter here, he was offering to sell instructions on how to take apart a system, and I don't know if it, I guess it's Bob wrote there, just no.
So I didn't even catch that. You're right.
Yeah, so I guess he wasn't willing to advertise quite anything someone came up with.
I wonder why that is. I mean, not that it's hard to take apart an Astrocade, but I guess if it was going to be illustrated. I wonder if he actually made those. That's interesting. Next up, we've got a letter by Boyd Perlson from February 26, 1979. And I like this letter. It's brief, so I'll just give a little overview of it. But he seems to be an accountant, and he's developed some kind of a system for his Bally to keep track of his chargeable time for each office client. And he wants to be able to make printouts of this, because currently all he's doing is, I guess, looking at the TV screen and writing down what he somehow stores onto tape or something like that. But I found this interesting because this is just another way that the Bally is used as a computer.
Yeah, you could definitely see the limitations, though, because, you know, there's no, like, out-of-the-box printer support, although people did eventually make printer interfaces for it.
Well, even if there had been out-of-the-box printer support, just working with 300-baud tape, I mean, hey, what a nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, I could picture maybe in 1979 walking into an accountant's office and seeing an Apple, but I can't picture in 1979 going into an accountant's office and seeing a Bally Arcade set up, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe between clients you can, you know, play some Cosmic Raiders or something.
Right. Yeah, he probably went on to get VisiCalc for an Apple, so he probably left the Valley far behind.
Yeah.
So let's see. Next up, we have a letter by James Wilkinson. This is from March 30th, 1979. This letter talks about the experience that James has running the game over from the February issue. He had to change a line number, and I find it interesting because what he had to do is he had to set X equal to it was originally 3164, which is the kind of where the ROM gets its name because that's where the game over routine is. Yeah, that's where the game over is changed, and he had to change X to be 3159, which is where game over is stored on the newer ROMs. So that's exactly where those ROMs get their nicknames from that little tidbit of information right there.
Yeah, and they had, you know, programs you could run to check which ones yours was.
Yeah, and they were simple. All they did was print something to the screen. Depending on what it printed, it was it told you which ROM you had.
Yeah.
But I want to make note here that this discrepancy is caused by differences between the versions of the AK ROM and Craig Anderson, who wrote programs, or really was Hoover Anderson Research Design, I guess. He eventually covers this problem in detail, but not for like 4 years. And the January 1983 issue of the Arcadian in an article called Sneak Up and Bite You. And he did this because he was writing programs for AstroBasic that people were saying, your programs aren't working on my computer, but they would work just fine on his. Huh. And it turned out that they had different versions of the ROM than he did. I mean, it was a pretty interesting article. I don't remember exactly what he said, but I want to summarize it by basically saying it was something like along the lines of he was pulling out his hair because he could not figure out. He'd have until someone, I think, lent him a ballet, and he had two ballets right next to each other running the same tape, and one was working and one wasn't, and he realized there's something with the ROM.
Yeah, that must have been frustrating.
Next up, we have a letter from Brett Bilbray. And this is just from 1979. It's not exactly dated. Brett sends corrections for a typing mistake that he made in Simon, as we talked about already. Many people had called Brett directly to find out how to fix the program, and Brett had no idea how they got his phone number. But he figured that it must mean that they're really interested, and he thinks that's pretty good. Yeah. Which I would be a little surprised. I'd be like, hey, what are you calling me for?
Yeah, so I mean, it looked to me like the letter actually said 40 people called him, which is amazing.
Wow, did it? I don't remember reading that. That is a lot of people. Wow. Here, if you find that, are you happen to look at that?
Yeah, it says many people, 40 or so, have called.
It sure does. Look at that. That's a lot of, wow.
Yeah, you could actually read Bob giving a note to subscribers in one of the issues, please don't call people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Brett mentioned that was getting kind of annoying.
Yeah. I guess it does tell you that people were typing in these programs, though, you know, because I wondered oftentimes, were people typing these programs in or not, you know, but I guess they were, or at least 40 people were.
Yeah, Brett said he was expecting even more letters from people, so you know, who knows how many people ended up contacting him.
Yeah,
so
that's true. Yeah,
it's good thing we have email now.
Yeah, and Skype, right?
Yeah,
this works pretty good. Another thing that Brett talks about here, getting back to his letter, is he was trying to transfer programs from one ballet unit to another over the phone lines, but he doesn't go into detail about how he was doing it. And he includes two programs for one of them is a sine subroutine and the other is Othello. And I think Sine, the subroutine, is eventually printed in the Arcadian, but Othello isn't. But it is printed like 14 months later in the June issue of Cursor, June 1980 issue of Cursor. Next up is another letter from Brett. This one is from April 1979. And I think it's written after the other one, but I couldn't tell for sure. But it's around the same time. He sends in another correction for Simon. So... It's one of the things I should mention to listeners is if you're actually going through the Arcadian newsletters, a lot of the times, most times, in fact, if there were any issues or any programs that had any problems, I actually took the corrections and put them on the same page. So if you, not that I expect anyone's typing these programs in anymore, I'm the only one crazy enough to be doing that, I think, but they are printed in there. And, they're not hard to find. And back in 1999 or 2000, when I contacted Bob Fabris and he gave me permission to reprint programs, and eventually when he gave me permission to put them online, that was one of his big worries, was that the programs, if I put them online somehow, that they'd have all these typing errors and people wouldn't know how to fix them. Huh. And it was it was because of that, from his conversation. I mean, it was through email, but my conversation with him, that was why I went out of my way to make these corrections in the Arcadian, because he was really, I mean, not worried, but he figured people would maybe type him in and be like, that didn't work. What the hell?
Yeah. Just like the good old days.
Yeah, just like the good old days. You don't want to make it too easy for people, do you? Brett makes a kind of an odd sounding comment here, but it's understandable when he says, many people have called in response to these errors. I am now writing to these people to help them with other questions and problems. So if there had not been any mistakes in Simon, I would never have had contact with other Bally users in this area. Also, many of these people now know of the users meeting coming up on May 12th, and we expect about 50 people, which is a lot.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, so I guess that's kind of the start of the Astrobugs group. So what do you say?
Yeah, pretty neat how it starts like that. And, you know, I think I've mentioned this to you before, but one of the ways I was going through the Arcadian back in the 90s, and I realized that there was a fellow who had started a user group here in Albuquerque. And I called him, and he was still in town. And I actually got together with him. He's the one who gave me my my blue ramp. So that was pretty interesting. He told me it was a Z-grass, but it's how I ended up finding that. So Brett notes that in the April 19 issue of Byte Magazine on page 193, there's a news article called Magnavox Files Suit on Microprocessor Video Game Patents. Included among these manufacturers are Bally. So I followed this up a little bit because I found the article, and then I found some information, and I'm going to give some background here because he doesn't go into it in his letter, but I found this interesting, and it has a lot to do with video games rather than just, you know, the Bally, but it's interesting. As a follow-up to this 1979 news, I came across an 11-page Activision case reading by Ralph Baer, who came up with the original Magnavox, or Brown Box, I guess, as a lot of people call it. And it's called The Video Game History, A Little Matter of Record Keeping, end quote. I am not sure when this was written, but it's probably from the 90s or the early 2000s. This is what he says, and this is all a quote. Let's examine the numerous stories floating around about the various video game patent infringement lawsuits that were carried on by Magnavox and Sanders Associates, the owners of the seminal Baer patents and of the Baer, Roush, and Harrison patents. Those lawsuits started in the mid-70s and ran all the way through the 1990s, the last of them for past infringement only, since the patents had long since lapsed. Bally, Seaberg, Mattel, Activision, Nintendo, Data East, Taito, and others fought lengthy legal battles against the Magnavox Sanders team in an effort to avoid having to pay license fees. They lost every single one of their lawsuits, both in initial actions and in various federal district courts, and finally, I'm not sure how to say this word, unanimously in the Court of Appeals. Then they had to pay up. So I found that pretty interesting, and I'm going to put that in the show notes, the link to that, because the whole 11 pages is pretty cool.
Yeah, I know that's, you know, kind of still an issue, you know, like, I think Nintendo got sued for their motion controls. And
oh, did they really? From the Wii or from something else?
From the Wii. I think they might have won that lawsuit, but, you know, it's always, you know, there's always somebody trying to make money when someone's successful with something, it seems like.
Yeah, the Wii sold a lot of units. It surely did. Brett closes his letter with, I am sorry for the mistakes in Simon and hope it did not cause too much trouble, but many users have learned something about debugging and a little about BASIC, sort of a learning experience. I will try to prevent further bugs from happening. Well, unfortunately, not just Brett, but everyone who prints any programs on the Arcadian, there's issues all of the time. And it's not just the Arcadian. It was every magazine that was available back then had something that was a bug fix area that you type in a program, and even if you made no mistakes typing it in, which you inevitably did, you had to usually wait till the next month to get a fix. And you were saying that you had a Commodore 64, but like mostly it wasn't until you got – so you never really typed in programs, I'm guessing, back in the 80s or anything, right?
No. Brett was saying that Bally was cutting the funding on the system because they wanted to do casinos. So
Yeah,
that kind of reminded me of what Dick Ainsworth was complaining about with, you know, Bally being more interested in the casinos than in their other gaming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess I did wrote down that right here. I just skipped that paragraph somehow. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, I wrote down that they opened up their casino December 29th, 1979, which I remember because I grew up on the East Coast. And when I'd visit my dad in New York, I remember everyone would go out to Atlantic City. And so to me, Atlantic City was like what I always heard about. I didn't hear about Las Vegas because everyone just went to New Jersey.
So I mean, I guess that's really all Bally does now, isn't it? Like slot machines and that sort of thing.
Yep. I'm sure they're still in business though, so that's pretty good. Atari's not in business anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, they've changed hands so many times, so they gave up a lot sooner than Sega did on their consoles, and for good reason. They're losing their shirts.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to when we get to some of the newsletters, because I was realizing reading ahead in the newsletters that there's actually more information available about the changing of hands, like how the companies went from Bally to originally a company called Fidelity was going to buy it, but that fell through before it finally became Astrovision that bought it. So pretty interesting, but we'll get to that further down the road. So this next letter is by John Collins. It's from April 12th, 1979. And John says, many of the stores in our area have not been able to be resupplied with the Bally arcades and have not been able to get the new tapes, and he means cartridges, even after 2 months' wait. This delay is so bad, in fact, that John asks, do you know whether or not they are even still manufacturing the basic unit? So that's just, I mean, this is only from the beginning of April, and I don't know how many units were sold before Astrocade came along, but it seems like there were issues from day one all the way until Astrocade started selling them. And I'm not just talking about the overheating problems. I'm talking about supply problems. So it's a wonder that there's people who still talk about the system to this day. John is working on a version of Hangman, Bowling, and a special spelling routine. He'll furnish a copy when the bugs are worked out, which I don't think he ever does, actually. Bob was having some trouble with his checkers program, but John says there's no glitches. Oh, and he kind of goes into detail about how the checkers works. Now, you said you've used checkers, so I haven't. But apparently, like, there's a number that's printed on the screen, and by that number, you can tell where in the program, like, because I guess otherwise it might look like it locks up or something.
Yeah, I mean, it can take a little while for it to figure out its move, because, you know, it's kind of these various routines it goes through, like, you know, checks, can it get any jumps, and then, you know, some different conditions.
Oh, okay. Do you know if, and I know you can't load programs into MAME from BASIC, but can MAME be speeded up? Like if we were to run, like, let's say you were loaded in checkers, can you like put it on warp speed or something like you can in most emulators?
Yeah, I don't remember the shortcut for it, but yeah, you can do that.
Well, that's cool then. So there's just one little last tidbit that the way John Collins ends his letter here is, he says, John, I wrote, John dictated this handwritten letter to his wife, which I found rather surprising. He ends his letter with, my wife's arm is tired, so I must close now.
Yeah, I don't.
That's a great way to end a letter. I think we should end the podcast that way sometime. My voice is tired. Bye, guys. Next up, we've got a letter from Mary Stank. She works for JSNA, and as soon as I saw this name, since I just finished reading Joe Sugarman's Success Forces, her name rang a bell, and so I wanted to read what her letter had to say. Joe originally hired her as a secretary, and over the years, Mary Stank continued to move up in the company, eventually coming, it seems, to become his right-hand woman. The short letter informs Bob Fabris that JSNA cannot provide him their, quote, list of owners of the Bally, as JSNA has a policy wherein they do not divulge this type of information to anyone, nor would Bob's material be of interest to JSNA since they have discontinued offering the Bally Home Library computer, end quote. So now we know. By April of 1979, JSNA had totally 100% given up on the Bally, which that's the best pinpoint that I know of.
So yeah, I thought that was interesting. They had no interest in dealing with them because it seems like nowadays they'd probably offer to sell their marketing lists.
That is true. Yeah, they probably would have. Which, you know, the Arcadian probably, because like something to talk about here is it was difficult to find out about the Arcadian in the early days because you didn't get like something in the mail from Bob Fabris says, hey, you should get the Arcadian. So there's probably until the Astrocade came out, there weren't that many. I mean, their issues were shorter, and there was a lot of material, but I don't know how many people were actually getting them.
Yeah, you'd almost have to hear about it through word of mouth, it seems like.
Yeah. But when the Astrocade shipped, in the box was a little postcard that said, hey, you should subscribe to the Arcadian. So at least everyone who bought an actual Astrocade in 1981 could, they knew about the Arcadian right out of the box.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good. Next up is, here's that letter by David Stocker that we were talking about. This is written April 23rd, 1979. David submits two of his tapes to Bob Fabris. These tapes contain a total of 23 programs. It seems that David took some of the programs from the Bally Basic Manual, changed them up a bit, or a lot, I don't know, and sold them on tape and as program listings. David would like Bob to inform, quote, the Arcadians, and I love that name, I really do, about his programs, which he sells as two sets for two different prices, which I talked about already, so I'll skip that. Both sets of David Stocker basic programs were added to the Bally archive on March 13th, 2015. Since these were available on tape, they are some of the earliest third-party programs available on tape for a game console. Mr. Stocker even beat Activision to the punch. So there, Activision. So it's too bad this stuff isn't up to, say, Pitfall quality, though. So, you know, I know it's not really a third party in the same sense that most people think of third parties today, but it still is programs written by someone who's not Bally and was available on tape, you know? The instructions for these two tapes provided the handwritten basic listings, and his script is quite small. But again, his sets are called Set 1, Games and Fun, and Set 2, Video Art. And these are available online. You can download these if anyone's interested.
Yeah, so they're pretty short. Like, it's like they say, like, you know, 21 or whatever programs, but like they're actually are, you know, multiple programs in a single load, and it just have a little menu and, you know, pick which one you want.
Okay. I think every single one of these, or nearly every single one of these, is from the Bally Basic Manual. So maybe what he did is put them in a menu for him, and that's what he changed. I don't know, because every single one of these rings a bell to me. But that's fine, you know. He was having fun. That's what it's all about. That's why I got a game machine. So here's what David Stocker replied when I uploaded the programs that you archived. He replied on March 16th. He says, wow, I had completely forgotten about that. At that time, I was in high school and working weekends at ABC Hobbycraft, a Bally reseller in Evansville, Indiana. I recall exchanging many letters and a few phone calls with Bob Fabris in those days. That was the software that I wrote for pay and about a million lines of codes ago for me. Engineering and software design became my livelihood. I am currently chief engineer in an industrial automation and robotics company. I believe I still have those rubber stamps that I used to create that awful artwork somewhere in the house. And then we asked a couple of questions, and he replied with a couple more things. He says, I don't exactly remember how many tapes I sold, but surely not many. Perhaps a couple of dozen, which actually is more than I expected to hear. My wife asked me, did it pay for your college? That would have been nice, he says. And the final thing he says is, I made more, although not much more money, refurbishing controllers in the store at ABC Hobbycraft. We had a standard rate for cable replacement, including the pots, which I did on a piece rate compensation off hours. I recall that we always drilled a small hole so we and the owner could spray the pots with tuner cleaner from Radio Shack. Huh. Yeah, pretty neat that he replied to us.
Yeah, there's a little bit more info in his letter about some programs he was working on. So he said he was going to do biorhythms, simple and compound interest, and a home records program. But yeah, I don't see any indication that those were actually completed.
Yeah, well, maybe just not. There's so much stuff that could be in the Fabris collection that we just are not aware of, you know. But you're right. Yeah, there's no indication that we have. But what we need is another biorhythm program. So
exactly,
we come across that. next up, we have a letter from John Perkins from 1979, from about April or May. I have a note from Mike White that I'm going to read too, that goes along with this. The Bally Astrocade, it only has 4K of RAM. This may seem like plenty of RAM when compared to, say, the Atari 2600, which only has 128 bytes of RAM, but 4,080 bytes of this 4,096 total bytes of RAM is actually all allocated and dedicated to screen RAM, so you can see it on the screen. This makes up the entirety of the Astrocade's 102 by 160 bitmap screen. The remaining 16 bytes of RAM are called the scratchpad. Things begin to get really confusing when you consider that the Bally Basic cartridge doesn't contain any of its own RAM internally in the cartridge, and yet somehow, almost magically, it provides the basic programmer with 1.8K of RAM to program the system. How is this done? Well, John Perkins wrote a handwritten letter to Bob Fabris, which provides some of these answers. This letter is the background and research for which is in the tutorial in the May 1979 issue, which is called Screen Operations. The tutorial, as printed, condenses the information that John provided to Bob. The tutorial also excludes a short example program that shows you how to have more than two colors on the screen. He gives an example how to show four colors. The letter explains how the basic program is hidden and stuff like this. So in the early 2000s, I had a phone conversation with Mike White. I don't know how I remembered this, but I did. I remembered that he said this article explained the details correctly, but that it was a bit muddled with some of his information. I couldn't remember exactly what Mike meant by this, so I emailed him back in the spring, and he provided me with a full explanation. And Mike says, John Perkins declares the program to be stored in the even bits, with the picture using the odd ones. This is computer geek thinking and not what an algebra teacher would say. In algebra, the digits are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, while computers, it's 0 to 7. Now, turn around to their natural format to become 8 to 1 and 7 to 0, respectively. Therefore, hex 5, 5 is actually even, and hex AA is odd, in computer use only. If you did this on a math test, Mike says, you would flunk out and maybe sent to the principal's office. So when you're, it is a little confusing if you're actually reading the tutorial because it seems backwards, and it is backwards. But that's how it was written. So there's a question for anyone who's listening to the podcast and is going to read the tutorial. And we're wrapping things up here with the last letter. This is by Doug Marker. It's from 1979, probably from September. This is actually probably my favorite letter because it's the most unusual of all these letters. Did you read this letter, by the way?
Yeah, it's the one from New Zealand.
Yeah. All right. Doug is a computer specialist working on an IBM-compatible machine. It's notable that since this letter was written in 1979, Doug must be working on IBM-compatible mainframe computers, as the IBM personal computer wasn't even released until August 12, 1981. Doug started his career as a hardware engineer, advanced to a software engineer, and eventually became a systems engineer for IBM. This type of in-depth knowledge of hardware and software is a common thread among quite a few letters in the Bob Fabris collection. Many users had technical backgrounds. What sets this letter apart from so many of the other letters in Doug's is Doug's location. He lives in Auckland, New Zealand, which is really far away from New Mexico, and really far away from you too. Doug doesn't explain how he came across the Bally Home Library computer in New Zealand. Perhaps he ordered it directly from JSNA from the original September 1977 ad in Scientific American. What's significant about this letter is that there is no PAL version of the Bally arcade system. Thus, Doug is using an NTSC system in PAL territory. This isn't unheard of. Many collectors do it today. But it's quite unusual, especially for 1979. Doug says, I am presently building a PAL modulator so that I can get color. So, Paul, do you think do you only get black and white if you're using an NTSC system on a PAL TV? Is that what happens?
Yeah, I'm not sure what happens, actually.
Okay. My only experience with PAL stuff is on the Amiga is that most of the later programs written on the Amiga were all for PAL. So you had to go into PAL mode and then the screen flickered. But I had the Amiga monitor could show PAL without difficulty. But if you hooked it up to your TV, which your Amiga could do, then the screen was rolled and the colors were all screwed up.
Yeah, I know sometimes the timing was different between, PAL and NTSC games and, all sorts of issues.
Yeah. Luckily, Japan was NTSC because so many games come out of there. It would have been an issue if it wasn't.
Right.
Let's see. So Doug Marker goes on to say here, the USA has a different color transmission system called NTSC, so I have to modify my Bally. He talks about working on upgrading his system's internal RAM to 8K or maybe even 16K, but he won't work on this until he has the PAL modulator working correctly. Doug has done some exploration on his own of the built-in ROM routines of the 8K system ROM, but he proposes a project that he would find useful, a list of all the built-in subroutines in the resident ROM and the basic ROM, which actually did come to fruition, but not from him. Let's see. Doug goes on to some depth about what he has discovered on his own. So it's kind of interesting to read in the letter, but I'm not going to go into it here. Doug's final discussion is about changing the speed of his Bally arcade unit, providing that the custom chips can handle it, which I don't think that they can. He intends to replace the basic timing of the microcomputer by replacing the master oscillator, which he has to do anyway so that he can get the PAL color frequency. So, anyway, I thought that was pretty interesting that there was someone working on it back then.
Yeah, I wonder if there was ever much thought given to making a PAL version of the system.
That came up from one of the people that we did an email interview with, and Astrocade wanted to make a PAL version, but I guess Bally had they didn't give Astrovision any of the information about how the chips are produced, so they couldn't actually go in and change the chips in any way. So they just had the chips as is. So they would have had to, I guess, reverse engineer on their own, which from what I understand about how Astrovision worked, I don't think they had the technology to really do that kind of stuff.
If you'd like to send any feedback, I can be reached at ballyalley@hotmail.com. That's probably the best way to reach me via email. If you're a member of Atari Age, and who isn't nowadays, you can reach me on there too. I'm Bally Alley. That's it. And there's also a Facebook page, which was set up by Willie when he was going to have this podcast. And I'm the moderator of it or something like that. But I only basically just joined Facebook and I don't use it at all. And but it does exist. There's a Bally Alley Astrocast on Facebook, and I probably should start using it more. But I don't know if you guys think I should use Facebook more, email me, because I probably won't see you post anything about it there. All right, talk to you next time. Bye.